Hello, and welcome back to Plantopia. Plantopia is the plant health podcast of the American Phytopathological Society, and I'm your host, Matt Kasson. I'm an associate professor of forest pathology at West Virginia University. This is the third episode of season four of Plantopia, and today I'm really excited to be speaking with, presumably, the oldest active member of our professional society, centenarian Dr. Manon Galligley. Dr. Galligley is an emeritus professor of plant pathology here at West Virginia University, where he has been on the faculty since 1949. Dr. Galligley was born April 11, 1923, in Mineral Springs, Arkansas. He received his BSA from the University of Arkansas in 1945, and MS and PhD in 1946 and 1949 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In between his master's and PhD work, Dr. Galligley was drafted into the Army during World War II, where he worked at Fort Detrick, screening pathogens of rice for use in biological warfare. Dr. Galligley has spent the last 75 years at West Virginia University, devoting his career to understanding and managing diseases of tomato and potato. He is well known for his pioneering work on the genetics, sexuality, and pathogenic races of Phytophthora infestans, including the discovery of the A2 mating type and the sexual state of P. infestans 100 years after it was named. He's also credited with the discovery of resistance to late blight in wild tomatoes that he used as a source for his tomato breeding program. In addition to his role as professor, Dr. Galligley also served as director of the Division of Plant and Soil Sciences from 1970 to 1986. During his tenure at West Virginia University, he taught courses including elementary plant pathology, principles of plant pathology, diseases of vegetable crops, and methods of research in plant pathology. Over his long career, he trained over 24 master's and PhD students. Dr. Galligley has published over 40 scientific papers over his career, including his earliest papers published in APS's journal Phytopathology in 1948 and 1949. In 2008, he co-authored the popular APS Press manual, Phytophthora, Identifying Species by Morphology and DNA Fingerprints. Dr. Galligley has received numerous awards for his work, including the AAAS Campbell Award for Vegetable Research in 1960. He was elected an APS Fellow in 1971. He has served on countless APS committees, including serving as APS Potomac Division President. He attended his first national APS meeting in 1947 and the first APS North Central Division meeting ever in 1948. We will be providing a link in the show notes section to showcase some recently unearthed photos taken by Dr. Galligley at that 1948 meeting. He has long been an anchor for the APS Potomac Division over the last 70 years. Manon, I'm truly delighted to welcome you to Plantopia. You grew up in a pretty small agricultural community in Howard County, Arkansas, where your family grew and picked cotton. Is that right?
We did. We didn't own cotton land, but we rented cotton land. We were pretty poor people as far as finances go.
Yeah, I think that was during the Great Depression.
Sure,
a lot of people were struggling, no doubt.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that you were exposed to agriculture and plant health from an early age. Like, what's your earliest memory of that time and as it relates to agriculture?
My earliest memory is asking my dad, why has the corn ears swollen up and become enlarged? And he said, oh, it's the weather.
Oh, so you're referring to corn smut.
Yeah.
So corn smut is the first plant
that's right.
Now, one of the pests that is often associated with the Great Depression and economic hardship in the Deep South is the boll weevil. Was the boll weevil problem on cotton when you were growing and picking cotton?
It was not too much of a problem, but it was there. We were aware of it all the time. Yeah.
You came of age during the Great Depression. You grew up in a humble agricultural community in Arkansas. Was college actually an option for you? Did you think that you could go to college, or was that something that you tested really well and you realized, wow, I might be able to do this?
I don't know what the reason was, but I found out that I could get a scholarship, and I did get a scholarship. I think it was a Sears Roebuck scholarship.
Okay.
And I went to the University of Arkansas.
So you went to the University of Arkansas, and I remember you telling me that you worked part-time with Dr. E.M. Crawley on a disease of rice called white tip.
Yeah.
Now, this was before Crawley determined a nematode was actually the causal agent of white tip. And it was thought to be a kind of a nutrient imbalance.
Yeah, I worked for a year or so in the greenhouse for Dr. Crawley, and I produced white tip with all kinds of nutrient deficiencies, but he would apply those nutrients in the field and still get white tip. That's when he realized that there was something else, and he was sent to Japan for some reason, and over there in Japan, he cut open the tips of the white and found the nematode there. So he reported that at a phytopath meeting after I had graduated and was in graduate school.
Yeah, I think he published that in Phytopathology in 1949, if I recall.
Something like that.
Yeah. And were those experiences with Crawley, were they pretty influential in you deciding to pursue plant pathology?
That and the walks on the campus with a V.H. Young. I don't know if you knew of him or not, but he was quite a guy.
No, I don't, but it's interesting to hear the things that inspire them to want to pursue a career in plant pathology. Certainly, those experiences working on white tip were part of the story, but not the complete story.
M. Crawley was a graduate of Wisconsin, and that was the reason I went to Wisconsin for grad. He got an assistantship for me.
Okay. So you finish your BSA in what I'm guessing is the spring of 45, and then you go to grad school at the University of Wisconsin. You start there, and shortly after you arrive, within about a year, something happens. What happens while you're pursuing your grad studies?
I was drafted.
So I was trying to figure this out, because when you look at when World War II officially ended in kind of the fall of 45, you were drafted after that. So this must have been part of the rebuilding and occupation of Japan.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know the reason. All I know is I was drafted. I went to Chicago area, and I think it was Fort Sheridan, and thought I would be turned down, but I never got back home again. I just went straight in the Army from my Fort Sheridan.
So then you went to Fort Knox for training.
Yeah.
And one thing that surprised you is that you thought you'd be heading to Japan with your company, but you were peeled off.
That's right. Because I had a master's degree in plant pathology at the time.
So in that short time that you were at Wisconsin before you were drafted, you did enough work that basically earned you a master's degree.
That's right.
And now you go to work with Birch Henry at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Lab.
Yep.
Tell us about what you did there.
I worked with Helminthosporium. On rice, as my job was to learn how to kill rice as a warfare agent.
Right.
A biological warfare is called.
Right.
And that's what I was doing.
So even after the Japanese surrender, World War II officially ends, they built up Fort Detrick to basically do, well, there's a lot of people there. They basically continue on with their biological warfare program of developing bioweapons to potentially use into the future.
I guess that's what it was at the time. I worked in the daytime in the lab, and I went to barracks at night. There was no army cafeteria, so we had to eat in the post cafeteria. And my bed was in amongst a whole bunch of air people. I think they were people that worked with the airways.
So you were there, what, 18 months?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the work you were doing there?
Yes, it's with Birch Henry, at the lab, yeah.
going back, you get out of the military, you're basically your time there ends, and you're back doing your PhD with J.C. Walker at Wisconsin. And you're working on bacterial diseases of tomato, if I recall. You told me a really funny story about Dr. Larson coming in and telling you and a fellow student that you were heading up to Oconto to the pickle packing plant. Yeah. You want to tell that story? Because I think it's funny.
The Oconto pickle packing plant in Oconto, Wisconsin, called the president of the University of Wisconsin and asked for help. So eventually it filtered down to Larson, who said, "Bannon, you and Ray Grogan have got to go up to Oconto." So we did.
So they were clearly having a problem with their cucumbers and their cucumber
plants. Right. And so they took us out in the field, and the bacterial wilt of cucumbers was rampant there where they started us in. While we were there in the field, the Oconto man said, "We started planting over here across the road, and we don't have it over there." And then we came up, and it just gradually got worse as we came up the hill and found out that they started with last year's seed, which was disease-free, and the seed for that year was infected with that bacterial disease.
So it was seed-borne bacterial disease.
Yeah.
So you tell them, "Hey, I know what your problem is. You just have bad seed."
That's
right. And what did they say in return?
We went back to their office building, and they wanted to pay us for our part. They said, "We can't take money because we are public servants."
Right.
And back your car up to this loading dock. Then they loaded it with pickles.
How many pickles did they load up in your car?
Oh, I don't know. They lasted until I graduated, and I brought some of them here with me.
That's funny. So you moved across the country to Morgantown with a bunch of pickles in your car, is what you're saying.
And the Oconto Pickle Packing Company.
All right. So in 1948, you're finishing up your PhD. You attend your second APS annual meeting in Pittsburgh, where you present probably one of your first conference papers, and you meet J.G. Leach, the head of the newly formed Department of Plant Pathology and Bacteriology here at WVU. What does Leach say to you? What happens next?
He asked me to come for an official interview. He and I talked at Pittsburgh, but then I went on back to graduate school, and then he arranged for an official interview. I flew in and got off at the railroad station down by the wharf area.
Yeah.
And they interviewed, and he took me to Huttonsville on the interview.
To the prison.
To the prison. He and the warden had become acquainted and friends, and the warden offered his farm as a place for research if you wanted it. So that's why he took me to the Huntsville prison farm. And I did my potato and tomato field plots there on that prison farm.
So for those of you not from West Virginia or unsure of what we're talking about, Huntsville is a town in West Virginia, and there's a medium security prison farm there. The prisoners do a lot of physical labor to run the farm. And when Manon started there, he was offered farm prison labor to help with his field trials. Now, this farm actually proved absolutely vital in your work to uncover late blight resistance in tomato during the 50s and 60s.
That's right. Yeah.
That led to the creation of your beloved West Virginia 63. Yeah. You also did some early testing of Zineb and Maneb, and that was when they were just still numbered, right? Now, during this time, you're testing new fungicides on potato. You're improving tomato disease resistance. This was a very important period in agriculture, often referred to as the Green Revolution or the Third Agricultural Revolution. Would you consider yourself part of the Green Revolution?
No, I just did my job.
Okay.
My job was to learn how to control plant diseases. And the diseases of the day were late blight and early blight.
Right. I think about you spend time in Toluca Valley in Mexico as part of a project on potato breeding for diseases and disease resistant with another famous plant pathologist, Norman Borlaug, who's often associated with the Green Revolution.
John Niederhauser.
And Niederhauser. Of course, Borlaug and probably Niederhauser were a little bit older than you, but were you colleagues with both of them? And was this through the Rockefeller Foundation, this work that you were doing in Mexico?
Yes, sir. It was through J.G. Leach and the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. They were together in Minnesota at one time, and they were friends. And so J.G. Leach arranged with the Rockefeller man to have me go to Mexico in the summer of 56, it was.
But you came equipped with a lot of knowledge of late blight, and you were reading for late blight resistance in tomato and working on fungicides for potatoes. So clearly you brought with you some expertise to that.
Well, I did potato breeding also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So was that a lot of fun being, because you were there, what, for a month in 56 when you were down there in the Toluca Valley?
At least a month. It seemed like the whole summer. And I worked with Dr. Niederhauser. We rode together to the valley where we had our plots. We would get in a pickup truck and take off from Mexico City to the Toluca Valley. You get over a little mountain and down to the Toluca Valley. And the Toluca Mountain overlooked the valley, and there were twin mountains, and Popocatépetl was the other one, yeah.
I remember you telling me that you said you'd always know if Norm was in the field because there'd be a bunch of people around him that he liked to talk.
Yeah.
And
I've got Kodachromes of those meetings.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I think what a lot of people think about you and your legacy, they, of course, think about your blight-resistant tomatoes.
There in Mexico, it was potato.
But in general, when we think about your career, we think about your blight-resistant tomatoes, and namely the West Virginia 63 that you released in 1963. Clearly, you've devoted a huge portion of your career to breeding for disease-resistant. But for me and for others, your contributions to the biology of Phytophthora infestans is pretty unparalleled. In the late 1950s, let's say around 1957, 58, you and your grad student, Francis Gaw, made a monumental discovery. You want to tell us about that?
I told him that we had these four isolates of Phytophthora infestans from Mexico, and I hadn't done anything with them yet. So I told him, ask him, you probably should pair them all up to see what happens. And he did, and he found out that the oospore, the sexual stage of Phytophthora infestans, occurred from A1 and A2. We named the A1 and the A2 in our work. When they were paired together, there was a line in the petri dish of heavy oospores. And it was very exciting. And Francis called me at home at 10 o'clock one night and said, I think I got oospores. I said, okay. I came in and we spent the night looking at them.
So you went up at 10 at night?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it doesn't matter what generation you're from. When there's a big discovery or a potential discovery, you'll run back to the lab to see what it is. It's especially interesting when a grad student says, I found something unusual. Yeah. And clearly that's what happened in that instance. Certainly that was in part inspired by J.T. Barrett's published work in the 40s. Where
he used other species and paired them up, and he got oospores in some pairings. And I read that article and abstract, and so I said we should pair up these isolates from Mexico, and we did.
So maybe this is Dr. Galigley saying that you should probably stay up on the literature because it might just lead to a breakthrough, huh?
Right.
Now, DeBerry, father of plant pathology, had elucidated the asexual kind of life cycle of P. infestans and performed the experiments needed to confirm its role as a disease-causing agent. But just over 100 years later, you fill in the missing pieces to understand the sexual cycle of one of the most devastating diseases of all time. Did that feel as big as it sounds to me and seems to me? Did it seem like a big discovery?
It was exciting in that we found the sexual stage of infestans after 100 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could speak for myself. My mom is 100% Irish, and her ancestors immigrated here in the aftermath or during the Great Famine. So a lot of us plant pathologists with Irish heritage can trace our story back to the Great Famine. So it's really cool that you were able to fill in some of the missing pieces on that 100 years later.
Yeah.
In 1960, you were awarded the AAAS Campbell Award for Vegetable Research for an outstanding single research contribution in either fundamental or practical significance relative to the production of vegetables. Was it for that discovery that you were awarded that Campbell Award?
That and other works that I did. I forgot what all I did, but I have published a lot of papers on diseases of vegetables.
Right.
Back in those days.
And also in 1971, you were made an APS fellow. And of course, some of that is around the work on biology of P. infestans, I assume. Did that work with Francis lead to a lot of new collaborations? Clearly, you were working with others on potato disease, potato breeding, you were working in tomato breeding. But did that discovery of the sexual state lead to new directions in your own research program?
I don't think so, because I've tried to maintain the idea that my job is to try to learn how to control a plant disease. And the discovery of the sexual stage didn't help too much, and because it was just part of the life cycle of the disease. And so I kept on working on ways to control late blight on potato and tomato.
So you certainly have a storied career as a plant pathologist with over 80 years of experience. But some of your more recent contributions to the field are as notable and impactful as your early work, especially your 2008 APS Press Manual on Phytophthora. This manual represents almost 60 years of morphological studies on Phytophthora, and it's sold close to probably over 1,000 copies by now.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Were you particularly proud of that work?
I've lost my copy. I don't have a copy of it anymore.
I'm hoping that maybe the higher-ups listening to this at APS might be able to get you a copy for your 101st birthday coming up. So
yeah, but they'll probably charge me for it.
Hopefully not. Obviously, late blight has been central to your work, but your tomato breeding efforts in recent decades have focused on another disease. Tell us about your work on Septoria leaf blight and why you got into that.
Yeah. Back in the early days of West Virginia, 63, we were in a period of cool and rainy weather. And now the weather has migrated to warm and rainy at times. And late blight ceased to be a problem. And then Septoria leaf spot came in and defoliated late in the season and exposed the fruit to sunburn and so on. And so I went to work on Septoria leaf spot resistance. And this year I released a new variety of Septoria leaf spot resistant tomato. And my dean named it Manon's Majesty. I suggested to him that it would be Mountaineer Majesty, and he said, no, it's Manon's Majesty. So, okay.
Okay, so you released this Septoria leaf blight resistant variety that also has late blight. You called it the West Virginia 23. The dean renamed it Manon's Majesty. How does this compare to your two other varieties, the Mountaineer Pride and the Mountaineer Delight, that you released in 2017?
The former resistance, multi gene resistance, there was a not complete immunity, and it would not hold up under severe Septoria infection. They would defoliate pretty badly. but they were better than 63 by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
We kept looking, and I remember Dr. Baker called me one time, Sir Manon, I detect that you're not satisfied with your resistance. I said, that's right, I'm still looking for a better resistance. And I found it in a wild tomato, Solanum habrocytes. It's a single gene resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that in the Manon's Majesty, and it's being distributed all over the state right now from our greenhouse.
That's great. Now, one of the other things that you've done that I think is really important, and I know that you're proud of, is that you basically deposited seeds with the World Vegetable Center for all your varieties or just the earlier ones?
The tomato breeder in the World Vegetable Center at the time contacted me and wanted my resistant tomatoes. And
are you talking about your West Virginia 63, or are you talking about the 2017 varieties?
The septoria resistant
ones. Oh, yeah, the Mountaineer Pride, the Mountaineer Delight.
Yeah, he discovered that I had a better resistance, and he wanted it. But we couldn't send it to Taiwan because they had a ban on importing tomatoes. We had to send them all out to Iowa State to be analyzed for seed-borne or systemic infections with bacterial and fungal diseases. Eventually, it took a year. It came out eventually all disease-free. And then we were allowed to send it to Taiwan. The government of Taiwan let them come in, and that's why I sent them to Taiwan.
That's great.
I don't know. I haven't heard from the plant breeder there since.
Yeah. I think I put my name in a hat for some of the Manon's Majesty seeds, but I'm not sure if I'll get any. Maybe I'll have to hit you up at some later time. So you turn 101 in April.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say you've had a long and fulfilling career in plant pathology. And it's also apparent to everyone who gets to know you that your legacy is really sound, meticulous science that has stood the test of time.
Yeah.
Your servant leadership style that elevates and celebrates others above yourself, and your absolute humbleness, if I might say. Do you think that's a fair assessment? What do you see as your legacy?
My legacy is, I don't know. I hadn't even thought about a legacy. I just keep working.
But in a way, these tomatoes that you're releasing, they're for the people of West Virginia.
Yeah.
They represent a lot of work, and they are part of your legacy.
Yeah.
To create something that brings, you know, nourishment and enjoyment and a lot of to many people. If you're a tomato eater, there are some people that don't eat them, of course. When you live to be almost 101 and hopefully beyond, many of the students you've trained and many of your colleagues have since passed. I don't pretend to know what that feels like, and I suspect it's a pretty weird feeling. But at the same time, I see you in every day. I see the way that you interact with people at the Potomac Division meetings. Everyone really has a deep friendship with you. And really, what keeps you motivated, inspired to keep working?
Oh, because it's fun.
Right. And I think a lot of people get burned out and stop working. This year, you've been retired more years than your career. So you had 37 years at WVU.
Right.
And you've been retired 38 years.
Yeah.
So you've been retired longer. But I would say that your work has been slow and steady that whole time, even since you retired.
Yeah.
What motivated you to actually retire, even though you were continuing to work?
Just age, so my wife and I could do some things together.
Mm-hmm.
Then I didn't feel obligated to come in and work for the university.
So when you did come in, it was to do the things you loved.
Yeah.
And that's my sense of getting to know you over the last 10 years I've been here, and maybe even longer at the Potomac Division meetings, is that you do very much love the things you do.
Yeah.
Even if it's frustrating, like sometimes, yeah, I think when you're having problems getting septoria into culture, keeping it in culture, but you persisted.
I've got it now. I know how to do it now.
Now, I'll give you a chance what the advice would you give to an undergrad who's interested in pursuing plant pathology the way you were back in Arkansas? Obviously, we're at a different time. We have different challenges in feeding the planet and agriculture, but what general advice might you give someone that wants to pursue plant pathology and wants to do what you do?
Yeah. If they enjoy discovering new things and new diseases or new, it's up to them. It's not, I can't tell a person, you go this way, they'll have to make that decision. And the only way they can make that decision is to enroll in plant pathology classes and learn about plant diseases. And if they like to work with them, then go ahead and do your graduate work in plant pathology.
But I think about your own background, going back to your humble roots in rural agricultural community, Arkansas. Presumably, you and your brother, I think, are first-generation college students. You were the first in your family to go to college, correct?
There were only two of us.
But your parents weren't college-educated.
No.
You were the first. So there's a lot of people out there that might still, no one in their family has gone to college, and they grew up maybe without the finances of other people. There's a path forward, even when there's limited resources.
My dad was a carpenter, an electrician, and he did all this labor work. My mother was a dietitian, and she worked in the school lunch program.
Okay.
And there was an FFA teacher there. I've forgotten his name, but he was inspiring. And I said, I'm going to go to college and become an FFA teacher. But I ended up doing other things.
One of the things that I wanted to tell you about that's maybe going to catch you off guard in a good way, hopefully, is that I've gone through and filed the formal paperwork to establish a travel award in your name for APS.
Okay.
So that students that want to pursue plant pathology, particularly agronomic crops, working with oomycetes or resistance breeding, will have opportunities in the future.
That's great. Yeah.
It's been great chatting with you about these things, but I felt like it was important that the larger society and beyond, because this podcast is not just for members of APS, it's for people that are enthusiastic about gardening and plants, and we'd like to just introduce them to plant pathologists from all walks of life and all career stages. And certainly, you are unique in being one of the few 100-year-old plant pathologists still actively working.
Yeah, still the vegetable plant pathologist for WVU.
So I have to ask, because it's right there, is tomato consumption the key to long life?
Yeah.
So growing your own food and eating that food might be part of the recipe for long life.
There's a tomato on my counter right now.
It's calling your name.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm looking forward to joining you at the Potomac Division meeting in March, where hopefully we can share some more details about your Gallagly Student Travel Award. Thanks so much for your time. We just heard from Dr. Manon Gallagly, Emeritus Professor of Plant Pathology at West Virginia University. We are excited to announce the establishment of the Manon E. Gallagly Student Travel Fund through the APS Foundation to honor Dr. Gallagly's numerous contributions to our field and our society over the last 80 years. We will be providing a link to APS's online donation portal in the show notes section immediately following the episode description. For more information, also check out the March 2024 issue of Phytopathology News to learn more about helping support this fund. Lastly, I'd like to wish Dr. Gallagly an early happy 101st birthday, which is on April 11th. I'm Matt Kasson, host of Plantopia. Thanks for listening.